We're discussing the rise of Hmong media entrepreneurs and the experience of Hmong Americans building from the ground up newspaper, radio, television ventures, often with meager resources. It's Hmong media culture here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As of 2019, there were roughly 327,000 people of Hmong ancestry living in the U.S. That's the Pew Research Center analyzing U.S. Census data. Milwaukee, Wausau, and Sheboygan are in the top 10 cities with the most Hmong American residents. And small media outlets cater to the Hmong community rising up in these cities. Do you feel your community or identity is underrepresented or misrepresented in mainstream media? Have you listened to Hmong radio? What are your experiences? 800-642-1234. Lori Lopez is a professor of media and cultural studies in the Communication Arts Department at UW-Madison, where she directs the Asian American Studies Program. And her new book is called Micromedia Industries, Hmong American Media Innovation in the Diaspora. Lori, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So Hmong Americans are this small population with no home country of their own. Give us the background first, that context of how they were political refugees of the Vietnam War and how they landed in cities like Wausau, like Minneapolis and Fresno, California.
Yeah, definitely. So Hmong people are an ethnic community and their original home was in Asia. There's maybe originally from southern China, but have also immigrated to Vietnam and Laos and other countries. And then during the Secret War, when the U.S. got involved in Laos when they weren't supposed to, the CIA started working with Hmong fighters. And then after the war, those Hmong families were being attacked for having partnered with the U.S. So they started fleeing to refugee camps in Thailand. And then from there, were eventually relocated to countries all over the world. And the U.S. started taking Hmong refugees in 1975. So the cities where we see large Hmong communities now are just the cities that had the, you know, infrastructure for taking in refugees. And Hmong families would start to gather in those cities or move to cities where there were larger Hmong populations. So yeah, now we see lots of Hmong people in the Twin Cities and in Central California and all throughout Wisconsin.
Yeah. You are not Hmong American, and you went into people's homes and had these really intimate conversations about how they're staying connected to their neighbors and their community and what media they're consuming. And it was interesting because sometimes they were skeptical of you, that they'd been here before being asked to take a survey and, you know, to do research on them and not just, you know, air their community's laundry. And what did you say to them?
Yeah, it was really important to take an ethical approach to this research because Hmong Americans are a small community and lots of people have been interested in them. And, you know, there's that the book, The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down, which Hmong people have become very frustrated with over the years. And it's kind of a one-dimensional portrait of their community. So I identify as mixed race, Japanese American, and white, and my research is all on Asian American media. So I do think it's really important that we learn all that we can about these minority forms of media that don't get talked about as much and that it's really important to understand. So I brought a translator with me into Hmong people's homes, and we tried to have a really serious conversation before the research started about, you know, how I would try to do something that helped Hmong people, that I was trying to tell their story, that I wanted to center their voices, and that I was trying to make something that, you know, people would be able to read afterward just to learn more about all of the amazing work that Hmong people are doing.
If you're just joining us, we're discussing the book Micromedia Industries with author Lori Lopez. You can join in. What type of media do you consume? Do you feel your community or identity is represented correctly in the media that you do consume? 800-642-1234. So, Lori, when you talk about telling some of these stories, centering these stories, I was really moved by your interview with 47-year-old Mee is her name, coming from the refugee camp. And it was when she learned how to use the iPad, right, the digital platforms like YouTube, where she could watch this endless supply of Hmong videos on any topic. And you met some of the entrepreneurs behind these videos. What are these operations like?
Yeah, what's going on behind the scenes was one of the most interesting things to me. I think it is amazing that Hmong people all over the world who maybe can't even read but can use an iPad are able to access these videos. But then what I was looking at is who is making these videos and what is going on behind the scenes. And what I found was that some of these channels or stations or news programs would look extremely professional. It would look like a traditional legacy media station, but behind the scenes, it would just be one person, one Hmong person in maybe their basement who has a day job doing something that's not media related. And they would just be shooting the video themselves and editing it together, and then maybe taking the video camera out into their community and doing interviews and going out into the field and doing all of this work with maybe just one person or maybe just two people. And together they would be creating this entire media landscape that looks like you're switching between channels, but really you're switching between just one person's perspective or one person's camera angles. And then, the algorithm is jumping you over to somebody else's content.
Yeah. And drilling down on that for a moment, your story of Richard Wangluvang and Swab Hmong News. And Richard told you he probably spends 25 hours a week on Hmong News, on putting out Swab Hmong News, which he considers full time, even though he has a full time day job as a software engineer in Milwaukee. And when you do the math, he's putting in minimum 65 hours a week. Can you kind of explain how these media entrepreneurs, as you call them, straddle these two worlds and do like a mega side gig?
Yeah, it is a really big side hustle. Yeah, Swab Hmong News is really incredible. And I think it just speaks to how much passion these media makers have for creating media, even when they know that they're not going to be able to be financially profitable, or even if they know that it's not going to be able to grow one day and become their mainstream, their main job. It's just something that they care about a lot. They're very passionate about helping Hmong people, telling Hmong people's story, and about giving them some place that they can hear about themselves, hear Hmong language, keep their Hmong language and culture alive. I just think that the motivation that they have for all of the goals of these Hmong media outlets is so profound that they're willing to put in all this time and effort.
Fascinating to me, too, that power within the Hmong community is concentrated in, an extremely small number of people, most all men who are putting out these media outlets. And they're pretty generous, big heart. They want to provide content for the Hmong community. What are the repercussions of that?
Yeah, I do think that there's still gender dynamics that we see in mainstream media in the U.S., where we mostly see white men who are owning media and then the centering the stories of white men. And I think that when you look at the Hmong media landscape, sometimes we see men's faces and men's voices and men's stories. But one of the other things that I encountered in my research is that many Hmong women are involved also. They're just maybe not as centered in the images or the people who are getting the most attention, because some of the forms of media that Hmong women are doing are even more innovative and experimental and are challenging the boundaries of what we consider to be traditional media. So Hmong women are definitely busy making media and very active, but the kinds of media that they make just aren't as recognized.
And we're going to talk about teleconference radio hosting in just a moment here. As we explore Lori Lopez's book, a UW-Madison media professor who interviewed dozens of Hmong media entrepreneurs and Hmong American news consumers to better understand the unique challenges and the struggles of what she calls this micromedia industry. What type of niche publications do you read or listen listen to? What draws you to these outlets? Why do you seek them out? Do you know how they're supported? What do you want to know about teleconference radio programs or the role Hmong women have in shaping communication? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Lori Lopez here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the scope, the reach of Hmong media industries and the challenges to keep putting out content. We're exploring Hmong media culture here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Author Lori Lopez explains the reality for many micromedia producers is that the process of media creation is solitary. It's isolating. But for Hmong audiences living in the diaspora with no homeland of their own, this array of television programming is deeply meaningful, she writes. Have you relied on a small media outlet to stay connected to your people? How do you think this media is created and supported? Do you gravitate to a micromedia industry because the content speaks to you? Join in 800-642-1234. The book is called Micromedia Industries. Lori Lopez stays with us. So Lori, teleconference radio programs, tell all on this. What are they?
They're a fascinating form of media that Hmong people have invented and that has become extremely popular within Hmong American communities. So basically what happens is somebody will open up a conference call, a massive conference call that can let up to 1,000 people or even more than 1,000 people call in at once just using their cell phone. But they treat it like a radio station where that conference call is live 24/7 and the owner of it will work with a team of volunteer hosts or DJs and divvy up the hours of the day so that there's a schedule. So it'll be like 1 hour where they're talking about health issues, or 1 hour where they're just talking about music, or one where they're giving advice. So kind of traditional radio kinds of topics. But they're very participatory, as you might imagine, because it's a conference call. So everyone who gets on can unmute themselves and talk. And the host's job is to kind of wrangle all these voices. And they've developed a real culture around taking turns and listening to each other. And it becomes a really important way for people to connect to Hmong people all across the diaspora. Sometimes people like call in from all over the world and they get to hear each other's voices and hear each other's stories and engage with each other.
And like minimal to no cost, because people have cell phones often with unlimited minutes, so they can just call in and stay live on these teleconferences.
That's right. It's really important for Hmong people to have a kind of media that takes pretty low tech, because a lot of people don't have an internet connection or a fancy laptop where they can do video broadcasting. I think now, and especially post the pandemic, we assume that that's a kind of digital literacy or a kind of technology that everyone has, but that's just not the case. Some people just have a cell phone and not even a smartphone, just one that places calls. But this is a form of media that elderly folks or people whose language skills aren't that good or who just can't afford to have a more technological setup can just call in and listen. And people will listen to it all day and all night. I've talked to many Hmong people who say, oh, my mom is always on those shows. She like goes to sleep at night listening to them.
I just can imagine like organized chaos. Like who knows when it's their time to speak? There's no call screener. I mean,
yeah,
you
that's
know,
right.
How do they keep the order?
Yeah. Well, so I can't understand Hmong very well. I took some lessons, but I definitely cannot understand Hmong language on these shows. So I do call in and I can listen and it does sound like one person talking at a time. Mm-hmm. But I've heard that in the early days, it was much more chaotic and people kind of struggling for the microphone. But the host does have the ability sometimes to mute people or to mute everyone and to say like, just unmute yourself using like this button where she can like usually control it a little bit. But more it is just about like listening and just letting someone be the person who's speaking instead of just trying to take over the whole thing.
You say she can control it because oftentimes these are women hosts. Is that right?
Yep, definitely. It's a lot of women who are the ones that start these shows or who kind of serve as the owner. And then a lot of women who serve as the DJs also.
How, and it's because I wonder why, because, you know, women, you've said, can fold this into their lives, but they're also talking about everyday and some very difficult topics like divorce, like domestic violence, like child brides. How do they broach these topics?
Yeah, these are some really serious topics in the Hmong community. And I think that's why it's so important for them to have a space to talk with each other that feels safe and that feels, and it's also anonymous because it's just the voice. So you can talk to Hmong people using these calls about something that's very private and the people don't use their names. And so you can share what's happening in your family or in your neighborhood with people who maybe don't know you or who are not going to out that they know you, because that's the culture of these shows, is to protect everyone. So I think it's been really important to have this kind of safe space for talking about personal issues.
It was really interesting, though. You found a lot of negative perceptions of these programs and that they were compared to online chat rooms. Why was there such strong, you know, feelings about that, you know, no, don't listen to these, or, you know, that they had such negative connotations?
Mm-hmm. I think that these shows fall into the kind of media that is seen as, and not everyone recognizes it as women's media, but there are a lot of forms of women's media that are seen as based around talk. Like, we can think of even just about talk shows, or that are based around personal feelings, that are based around intimate subjects. And a lot of those forms of media are delegitimized and mocked as somehow less serious than talking about, like, news or current affairs or doing that kind of programming. So I think there's a skepticism of the content. I think there's skepticism of the fact that women and women's voices are the ones that are being lifted up here. We can think about histories in all media where women's voices are policed and the way that women talk is mocked. So I think there's a lot of cultural traditions that lead to this becoming delegitimized, but also just because it's new and different, and, and it is unauthorized and unregulated. Like, anything can happen on these shows. And people can swear and people can tell, like, dirty stories. There's just so many things that people would say, oh, it's not regulated. It's not like a regular radio show. Like, if I listen to a professional radio show, I know they're not going to be able to talk about those kinds of things. So I think there's also a kind of skepticism of it.
We're talking with Lori Lopez, a professor of media and cultural studies at UW-Madison, author of the new book, Micromedia Industries, Hmong American Media Innovation in the Diaspora. Lori, it made me wonder, you know, your research, it seems, ended before the pandemic. How might the pandemic be affecting the micromedia industry?
Yeah, I have been wondering about that also. I think that what I have learned in my research is that Hmong people are very adaptable and resilient. And, you know, part of what I wanted to study in this research is how they've adapted and been resilient to the struggles that they have already faced and the things that they have already overcome. So I'm confident that these forms of media will maybe not survive in the same form, but they'll survive in some form and perhaps even grow stronger, because there's so much attention being put on how are people using tools like conference calls to connect to each other. So I actually think that Hmong people were probably positioned really well to thrive during the pandemic in terms of these kinds of media, just because they already had such a robust media, a robust way of communicating, even when people are, you know, isolated from each other and can't, like, get into the office to make this kind of media.
Well, it just made me wonder about teleconference radio programs in the era of a pandemic, when there is so much misinformation out there. There is so much information being exchanged, public health information. It really would seem like the right platform for teleconference radio programs.
That's right. And it is a really important time to be thinking about how misinformation and disinformation is propagated. And I think that's something that nobody has really solved yet, whether it's Hmong Americans or Asian Americans more generally, or just all kinds of Americans. Mm-hmm. I think that we're all really struggling with how do we regulate disinformation when there are so many outlets for people to be propagating misinformation.
When you talk to these entrepreneurs, and you call them entrepreneurs, not journalists, why did you choose that terminology about these people who run these media outlets?
I think it's really important to recognize the work that they're doing as in innovation, and starting multiple businesses. So one of the ways that Hmong American media outlets survive is because behind the scenes, the person who is running them is actually running multiple outlets where they have a newspaper, but they also have a photography business, or they also run like an arts nonprofit or something. There's so many things going on behind the scenes. So I wanted to call attention to how it's not just one enterprise, but it's often multiple enterprises, and also the innovation that's happening. So we think of the term entrepreneur referring to people who are doing something that is kind of changing the industry or being innovative in some way. And I definitely think that Hmong media owners fall into that category.
Lori Lopez studies disenfranchised groups within mainstream media. Her new book delves into media resources in the Hmong community. Do you seek out small micro media outlets? How do you interact with their content? Are you a journalist of color? What is your experience reporting on your community? Join in at any point, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Lori Lopez and meet the host and producer of Hmong Radio, airing in Western Wisconsin and Minnesota, right after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're exploring Hmong media entrepreneurs and the rise of Hmong American media outlets like radio, like newspapers, TV stations, operating with little or no staffers. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, UW-Madison Media and Cultural Studies Professor Lori Lopez. She provides an examination of Hmong media cultures in her new book. It's a way of showing the breadth and depth of Hmong American experiences. Is there a small media outlet that speaks to you or has perhaps disappeared in the pandemic? How does that make you feel? How do we shift from the majority white voice in mainstream media? Join in 800-642-1234. Lori Lopez stays with us. And let's bring in Cam Yang now, who is a producer on Hmong Radio WIXK that airs in Western Wisconsin and Minnesota. Also a co-host of Belong Radio, a Hmong LGBTQIA plus radio show. Cam, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Well, explain the Belong program, which was broadcast in Wisconsin and Minnesota. Why did you choose that name?
Yeah, so Belong Radio is a biweekly, it started in 2014. It went on for a few years. We unfortunately ended it a few years back, but Belong, it translates in the English language to leaf, and me and the other co-hosts, Sonic Green and Chu Feng Zhang, we decided to name it Belong Radio, because back in Laos, back in the jungles when, in the homeland when our families were still there, The only way to really communicate across the mountains easily and accessibly was through a leaf, and our language. I don't have the exact word, but Hmong language is a language where you can communicate through leaves and through music. It was a communication tool, and we felt like that was the most appropriate name for our radio station or our radio program.
If I understand this correctly, your mother is a pioneer who stands out within Hmong radio because she being the only female radio station owner. What has she taught you?
Many things. I think she's extremely empowering. She's very humble, actually. She doesn't introduce herself as that. I think my dad is more excited.
Well, we will introduce her as that.
Yeah, I love it. My mom, Maya Ving, she's a wonderful person. She's taught me how to really be empowered, be creative, be proud, and really empowered me to even be a queer trans person in the Hmong community. So.
And that was certainly a reach. What have you taught her and so many others about your voice in the LGBTQIA community?
Very similarly, being proud, being out. With the radio program, we've definitely introduced many ideas. It's such a taboo in the Hmong community to talk about queerness and transness and sexuality and gender, really. And it's a new concept, quote-unquote concept, right? We don't have a word for queer or trans in the Hmong community. So we've, like in the book, Lori's book, there's Caleb from Madison, actually, a good friend of mine. They stayed really well. And they've coined multiple new queer words in the Hmong community, and like introducing those in our language through our radio programming, introducing these topics and conversations.
Yeah. Lori, jump in here with what you have seen in the content and pushing boundaries in the language.
Yeah, it's been really exciting to see queer people using media to tell their story, because it's just so important to say we are a part of this community. And the way that I talk about Camelot in the book is just how much joy there is surrounding the Hmong radio show and some of the other ways that queer people are telling their stories, is to be like, we love ourselves and we have friends and we're just here to say that, like, we have an existence, and it's politically powerful, but it's also just being a normal, regular Hmong person too.
Yeah. And Lori, I remember that when you interviewed Cam's mother in the radio station, she expressed it is a bit isolating, just you in there alone and just playing the music.
Yeah, I think that happens a lot with micromedia, that part of what happens is you do feel like you're all by yourself, because there's no team around you to help take up some of the different roles, to have like an editor and a producer and a bunch of different people who are helping figure out what's going on or come up with ideas, that sometimes it is just one person all by themselves. But one of the other fun things about micromedia is that because it's changing all the time and inviting new people in, sometimes there is opportunity to work together. And I think Cam's show was really about that, by saying like, well, you know, we're not getting paid for this. Anyone can come in. Let's just bring in all of our friends and let's have fun making this radio show.
Cam, does that sound familiar? Is that kind of how it went?
Yeah, that's absolutely how it went. I think that's really how it started, and that it flourished and became something bigger than the three of us.
What was the feedback you received from the topics that you discussed on the radio program?
Yeah, surprisingly, really positive feedback. I think everyone was very open to having these conversations. We've brought in international, like, Hmong pop stars from like Thailand and Laos, and there were we at the end of the programming, we would introduce the fact or the conversation, and they were always open to having these conversations, and open to and, you know, even share with us about how they have queer friends or trans friends. So it, surprisingly, always or not surprisingly, I guess, Hmong people were very great and inclusive, and so it's I think. Been a wonderful experience.
Cam Yang is with us, producer on Hmong Radio. WIXK airs in Western Wisconsin, Minnesota. Lori Lopez, new book on the Hmong community, media, professor of media and cultural studies at UW-Madison. You can join in. Do you listen to Hmong Radio? What do you think of it? How do you engage in the media, or how do you, you know, engage in media regardless? Do you write letters to the editor or leave Facebook comments? What is the response? Join in at 800-642-1234. So, Lori, you know, when you look at Hmong now off the airwaves, where do you find that the media fills that void that Cam, you know, now that void is there, what comes up in its place?
That's a great question. I think maybe Cam can answer better than me what other kinds of Hmong media have sprung up in its place. But I do know that everyone who is involved in making Hmong media is someone that will go on and make other kinds of media. I know that even Cam's co-hosts are people who are out there also making music and supporting artists and doing other great things. So I think that it's just part of the, people are always migrating from one form of media to another, like any form of media comes and goes, TV shows rise and fall, and radio programs. So that's kind of a normal cycle. And I think there's always new people that are coming to take their place.
Yeah, Cam, how do you continue to create and carry your voice after one project ends? What has happened since?
So we've unfortunately decided collectively to end the show and decided to refocus our energies. Just like Lori stated, so Shona and Chu Bang, they're still doing wonderful music, producing, and similarly, not a I'm the only individual who doesn't really have a foot in music or any of that, but visual artists, I think all three of us are great storytellers, right? That really brought us together. But different ways of telling stories, for sure, just through different mediums, are ways that we've moved away from media.
Lori, how have you found that media entrepreneurs are storing audio archives?
Yeah, that's been really important because radio is not a form that lends it's that's easy to capture. A lot of times, maybe this will be turned into a podcast later for the Wisconsin Public Radio Station's website, but not all live radio shows have the capacity to do that. And that means that you either have to listen live or it's gone forever. And one of the things that I thought was really cool about Mbong was the way that they did a Facebook Live video broadcast of their show too. So then if I missed their show one night, I could just watch the Facebook feed of it and it would be stored on Facebook and I could even see a video of all their faces, which is even more fun to watch. I could see what they were doing and there would be lots of dance parties that I could enjoy. So I think that was one way that you could turn a radio show that doesn't have the capacity for turning their recordings into a podcast archive into something that folks could still tune into later on.
Kim, how did you go about choosing what music to feature and where you find those musicians to feature?
Yeah, we definitely prioritized Hmong queer trans, or even Asian queer trans artists and musicians, whether they're just a drummer or the bass guitarist within the band, but prioritize that. Also prioritize just Hmong music that we enjoyed, Asian music that we enjoyed, and that really helped along the way.
Well, Cam, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Cam Yang is a radio producer, community organizer, and podcaster advancing Hmong radio. We also have Lori Lopez with us, UW Media and Cultural Studies professor, staying with us. Her research goes deeply into Hmong media culture. You can join in. Are you familiar with Hmong radio or other micromedia industry outlets? What do you think of connecting with your community through these platforms? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. We're spending the hour exploring Hmong media culture, the strength of Hmong oral culture, and the long history of radio as a culturally resonant medium for Hmong communities. UW-Madison professor Lori Lopez interviewed dozens of Hmong media entrepreneurs for her new book called Micromedia Industries. You can join in 800-642-1234. Lori with us for about 10 more minutes. Lori, you talked with Steve Tao, who is a media entrepreneur, was frustrated with the lack of Hmong journalists that it was more advantageous for Steve to train up a volunteer than to hire a person with the requisite journalistic training. What did you see there?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of issues. This is kind of an issue in Asian American media more broadly, that we just need to encourage more Asian American young people to get into media production and to, well, maybe go to school like in communication arts at University of Wisconsin-Madison and learn media production skills. but I think some people, you know, don't understand that it can become, well, I guess become a career in some ways, or be just something that you can do even just because you want to do it. So it's important for kind of leaders and folks who are involved in Hmong media to be able to train young people and encourage more people to develop those skills.
You know, I was listening to Hmong Radio yesterday and thinking about this segment, and heard, of course, listening to music, but heard an ad for the University of St. Thomas, which was partially in English, partially not. How does advertising work in Hmong media culture?
Yeah, so one of the most important things about that I learned about Hmong media is that not a lot of it is advertiser supported, because if we think about the logistics of advertising, advertisers are always, or corporations that use advertising are always trying to reach the large audience, or an audience that they think is most financially valuable. And in so many ways, Hmong people are just too small of an audience to really want to target, unless it's for like a Hmong store or a Hmong restaurant or something that is specific to Hmong people. So that's been a real barrier for Hmong media, that they can't always rely on advertising. So I think radio has had to, because a lot of radio stations or radio programs still have not moved away from the model of needing to sell advertisements, but other forms of Hmong media have. They just are not reliant on advertiser dollars. They find other ways to support themselves, either by being extremely low cost and behind the scenes so that they can publish on a shoestring budget, or through just coming up with other alternative ways of funding themselves.
Yeah, and you know, radio stations are very expensive. Getting a station license, cost prohibitive for perhaps a micromedia entrepreneur. And so they're going to have to find some other means. And so there are all these like quasi-digital platforms that we've also seen rise up. But where do they find the means? Where do they find the money to put out, you know, to put out the media?
Yeah, that's right. So if we think about just radio itself, you know, it takes a lot of money to own an AM FM station or a channel. I think that sometimes we forget that in the world of even more expensive media like film and television, that a radio station itself is very expensive to buy and to maintain, and to have like an engineer, all this technological know-how. So one of the alternatives that Hmong people have done is to purchase sub channels of an FM station, which is less money to cost and to own and run, but then people have to buy a special radio receiver in order to get that channel. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they just have an hour here and there on community radio stations. Community radio stations are all volunteer run, and a Hmong person can maybe just get an hour once a week and be able to still talk in Hmong language and give Hmong news and bring on Hmong guests. And then, of course, the last option is that teleconference radio program that I was talking about, that's free to run because it's a conference call. So I think that instead of coming up with ways to find money to support Hmong media, it's more about finding alternatives that don't cost as much money.
You also found that buying 1 hour a week just isn't enough to share all the news, all the culture, everything you want to do as far as programming.
That's right. So I think it's really important that Hmong voices are included in community radio stations. Like, for instance, in Madison, we have WORT, and there's been a Hmong show on for many years. And I think it's important that when people tune into that station, they can hear Hmong voices and Hmong music, as you mentioned, that diversifies our mainstream radio landscape. But it's also important for Hmong people to have a 24/7 radio station or other form of media where they can always tune in more than just 1 hour a week, which is definitely not enough for any community.
You know, one entrepreneur said they want to present positive news, you know, positive news as a counter to how Hmong are often portrayed in mainstream media, to counter those negative stories. What did you find there?
Yeah, this is a struggle for any minority community. And in my studies of Asian American media more broadly, we see this too, that in the beginning, there's a real fight for positive representation because that counters negative stereotypes. The idea that Hmong people are always struggling or that they have some sort of weird, exotic, strange culture that is holding them back in some way. That's a really important narrative to get away from. But on the other hand, it's also a lot of pressure for a community to only represent itself in a positive way. And then there's what we are actually seeking out would be nuance and complexity and depth. There are so many things that once we have a really lively, rich media landscape, then we can get that kind of depth and nuance without having to worry about it always being positive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, certainly those difficult subjects that we talked about before on teleconference radio programs, they too, in other formats, can have a backlash. And even people in the Hmong community can say, no, let's not talk about that. Or no, do not write about that.
That's right. I think all minority communities have to worry about things that will bring shame or portray their community in a negative light or make people get the wrong impression about them, to think about that in an isolated problem is the entire culture, that entire culture gets reduced into one negative stereotype. So those are definitely things that all minority communities worry about a lot.
How does this research fit into the larger scope of your research and how you look at underrepresented and misrepresented communities through media?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I do look at Asian American media more broadly, and I think that Hmong American media is important to understand as just one component of that, and thinking about how does a community that has been underrepresented and misrepresented fight to tell its own story. But I also think it's important that what Hmong people are doing in having a whole media landscape populated by outlets run by just one or two people, not financially profitable, just being in the position of telling stories, is something that we are seeing everywhere in every kind of media, but we often just don't recognize it, that there are, rural newspapers serving small towns in Wisconsin, or musicians who are just posting their songs to Spotify, or almost all podcasters are in this position. So I also think that what I'm learning about Hmong media can help us to look beyond just those massive media conglomerates that are putting out like streaming TV shows, to look at individual people who are populating our media landscape in ways that are really meaningful to other people.
It makes me wonder then, what is your forecast for Hmong American media industries? Will they be able to thrive? Will they be able to grow, proliferate?
I think they will. I think that because Hmong people are always going to be a small population I don't want to say they'll always not have a home country, but they're always going to be an ethnic minority within a larger culture. I think that we're not going to see like an enormous breakthrough to mainstream media. And because of those limits in size, I think that we're just going to see more of these kinds of micromedia outlets. And I think that we'll see other kinds of technological innovation because, you know, who knows what direction social media is heading in or our cell phones are heading in. But I just think there will be lots of innovation in the future.
We'll stay tuned. Lori, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lori Lopez, author of the book Micromedia Industries, Hmong American Media Innovation in the Diaspora. She's a professor of media and cultural studies in the Communication Arts Department at UW-Madison. Earlier, we heard from Cam Yang of Hmong Radio, WIXK. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.